Hello friends, Joel, producer at the Zeitcast here. In today's episode, we welcome back return guest Stephanie Tate, as Stephanie and Jonathan discuss the unique moment we find ourselves in, what it means to do real church, and the voices we should be listening to in this particular moment. Stephanie is an author, speaker, disability advocate, and trauma survivor, who speaks particularly to the assumptions of the prosperity gospel that underwrite so many of our unhealthy ideas about faith. In her book, The View from Rock Bottom, Stephanie describes how she came to find God in her own pain and ableism in the church. Welcome to the Zeitcast.
Welcome back to the Zeitcast, everybody. You know, we haven't had a lot of, because it's still, I mean, the podcast is, this version of the podcast has only been around for a few months, so we haven't had a lot of return guests already. So one of the few is Stephanie Tate, my good friend, who I want you to be a regular feature on this podcast forever.
Aww.
So I'm so thankful that you'd be willing to take the time with everything else.
You know me well enough to know I won't run out of things to talk about, so we're good.
No, and I don't either, and that's why we're so great together. Like, it's a lot of kind of combustible energy between the two of us, I think.
It's like very ADHD, right? Like, we'll just both talk over each other, but both hear what the other person's saying still in track.
Holy, it goes somewhere.
People around would watch somewhere and be like, that is so rude, but when you know, you just... I don't know. It's just who we are.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Well, I'm just, I love talking to you, Stephanie, and I'm so thankful you would kind of take this time. And we've been in touch a lot these last couple months. And before we jump in things that I really want to talk about today in terms of specifically some of the things that you're thinking and feeling just with the world starting to reopen and how some of these realities affect the church. And I'd want to ask you about that. But first, these last 68 days or so, I know have been uniquely challenging for you. So I'd love for you to say a bit about what have these last 68 days been for you? Can you say a bit about this particular leg of the journey and what that's meant?
So I'm in Oregon, and yeah, according to my little app I keep on my phone because time blurs together, it'll be 10 weeks this Thursday that because I'm immunocompromised and because I'm disabled, it sounds weird to say it, but I was in that group that was sort of the canary in the coal mine, right? We saw this coming and pleaded with people to listen long before places forced anything to shut down. So I actually pulled my kids out of school like 2 weeks before the schools shut down here. That's why our isolation's been so long. So my husband basically told his boss that he was going to be working from home for a while and got what he needed to do that. And 9 weeks, 5 days ago, we hunkered down in our house and we have not left since, other than a couple of times when I had to go get emergency medical care. That's it. We don't go to the store. We're delivery only. We don't go to public places to get a breather and a walk around. We're literally just at home. It's been a bit of a roller coaster. It's a lot of complex feelings at once. I'll try to sort through best I can. In the beginning, some of it didn't feel so bad because for me, being at home for weeks at a time is not necessarily a new experience. Because I'm disabled and chronically ill, in the winter, I spend a lot of time effectively bedridden. And before we got my Lyme properly diagnosed, there were years where I was, you know, in bed 4 or 5 days a week. That was pretty normal for me. So in the beginning, I kind of felt like, okay, in a way, maybe I'm prepared to deal with this. But I've never had to do it with my husband and my kids home the whole time, and no ability to have anybody pop by and say hello and hang out for a few and give you that refresher, right? Just me and taking care of my family. That's been new. And as the weeks drag on, especially knowing that there are no breaks, there is no, well, this one weekend we'll go out and see some people and then come back in. Like, it doesn't work that way. Knowing that this is just sort of an indefinite, we don't know the end date, this is going to go on forever, that's emotionally very different than processing, this is temporary, I can get through this, I'll be back out in a few weeks. Like, it's a very different experience. So the coping skills that worked before for temporary weeks in and here and there, I don't know, I feel like they're not really cutting it anymore. This is something very new. So I'm sort of shifting into this new season of how do I do this very long term. I'm processing a lot of that right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like not necessarily an end in sight.
No, I mean, for us, there's not, because we're not in that camp that's like, well, as long as they reopen things, we can slap on a mask and go out there. And, you know, I have permanent heart damage and I have some existing immune problems. And because of past cancer treatments, I have some immune deficiencies that are significant, and it would not be safe for me to go out there. And so because I was sick, very sick for the first, you know, few weeks, month and a half of this, and we don't know for sure what I had. I never had a COVID test. So is there a chance that I had that and had some antibodies? I guess. But my doctors sort of put the fear of God into me that unless I know that for sure, I need to operate under the assumption that I had a bad flu that turned into pneumonia and that I don't have any antibodies. Because if I go out there assuming that what I had was COVID and I come in contact with COVID, I'm not one of those cases that's just going to sit at home and have a bad cough. Like, it's very likely I will be one of those cases in the ICU. So for now, until proven otherwise, I need to operate under the assumption that it would be life-threatening for me to come in contact with that virus. So it doesn't matter. I mean, my governor could reopen absolutely everything tomorrow, which they're not going to do in Oregon. But even if they did, it wouldn't change things for me. My family's, all four of us, have to stay home until we at least, well, I mean, I've had to figure out what that, you know, until what, right? And for us, I mean, there's a few possible options. If our country could get its act together and get enough tests and get enough contact tracing where we knew we could isolate, you know, bubbles of cases and know where they're at and case numbers really plummeted, there might be a way in which, you know, we could go out in limited capacity. But I don't see us doing that right now. So for right now, my family's left back at, until there is either a vaccine, which we are at least a year and a half away out, or a really successful therapeutic medication that means that this is not so fatal if you get it, which, you know, could happen, but that's not a given. Short of those two things, I mean, there's no putting on a fabric mask and going to Costco for me. Like, that's just not a thing.
Yeah.
Nope. So we'll be here indefinitely. And that's tough because I have two kids, right? Mm. I have one who's supposed to start middle school this fall. And I have another who is a first grader going into second grade. And if we don't have safety, I can't enroll them in traditional school in the fall, or there'd be no point in keeping me home.
Right.
They'd just go and pick it up and bring it home.
Yeah.
So whatever's safest for me, unfortunately, that's what has to be all four of us.
Yeah.
So we're just kind of trying to process the emotions of that in waves right now. Because it's a lot to take on at once. You kind of have to take it in chunks.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like so much to feel. Some of the conversations, Stephanie, we were having off air before we started. What's your sense of, I mean, because I feel like you always have a prophetic voice and perspective. Do you feel like that this is a kind of moment where people are waking up and starting to see the world from a different point of view, or especially, I mean, like I'm here in Oklahoma where we're one of those places that's kind of in a mad rush to open as quickly as possible. I mean, restaurants opened this weekend in Oklahoma, you know.
Because you know, if I see a picture of you in a restaurant, I'm going to text your butt so fast.
Yes, yes, I would assume that
you will be getting a series of frantic texts.
I would expect nothing like that. Like, what's your do you feel like that this is a time where there's a kind of, and even for, you know, among people of faith, a kind of reflection where you see things changing, or is your sense that that's not necessarily where this is going?
It's hard to say, but I feel like this could have been one of those times. I think it had the potential to be one of those times and the opportunity to be one of those times. In my experience, I don't really see that happening a whole lot, though. The rush to reopen things, and not just start the reopening process, but like 0 to 60, we're just going to fling open the doors. This thing's over. Hope for the best. Tells me that people haven't really even begun to grasp what we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
It seems like we've just come to a place where, I'll be blunt and say, it seems like people stayed home for a month, if they even stayed home in that month, and decided that was their limit. They were bored with it. And so if we have to sacrifice, you know, some of the vulnerable to get things back open and back to normal, then so be it. That sacrifice is worth it. That's what it feels like sitting on this end, is that people have essentially decided, you know, yes, some people are going to die, but oh, well, like that's just the cost of doing business. Mm. It doesn't feel like we learned a whole lot then. Mm. It feels like the exact same sort of institutionalized ableism the people like me have been trying to say for years, like, hey, ableism is violence. It's not just some like, ooh, whoops, are bad. It's violence. It hurts us. It puts us in danger. It kills us. And now we have such a blatant example of that coming to fruition, this idea of, well, you know, vulnerable people, you're going to have to fend for yourselves because the rest of us need to get back out there. So you'll figure out something. And if you don't, yes, inevitably some people will die, but so what? I mean, my wall on social media is full of, well, people die in car crashes and people die from the flu and people die of heart. It's so sad, too bad. That's just life. We don't shut down the economy for that.
Right.
It's amazing how quickly we swung to, we're just going to accept a certain amount of death as inevitable as opposed to a national tragedy, right?
Yes.
Like we have death tolls that are nearing 9/11 levels every day.
Yeah.
And yet, I haven't seen a single, like, have you seen a single news piece that's like, let's string together some stories of who these people were and really, no. You know, talk about our dead. Or let's put together a memorial where we write out their names somewhere, a la 9/11. Or like, we have all just sort of shrugged these off as statistics of some people died today, but at least it was less people than it could have been. So I guess that's okay.
Right.
Like, right. I don't see any sort of serious heart level change happening. If anything, I'm scared that we've become more callous, that we've just accepted that, well, as long as it's only old people and people that couldn't work anyways, then oh well, but at least it wasn't us, you know, real people that have jobs and have value.
Yeah,
I mean, that's kind of what I'm hearing. If anything, we've doubled down on the ableism, that your life has value if you have a traditional job and contribute to the economy in a traditional way.
Yeah.
And if you don't, well, it's sad that you died, but it's not sad enough that we should do anything significant to try to stop it.
Right. Right. Oh, that's precisely what I'm hearing, Stephen. And you know what, if you don't mind, I'm going to hit the pause button real quick just to close this door because I'm getting,
hear it now.
Noise coming from outside. That's a little quieter. I think that's from somebody's yard. Yeah, definitely not hearing that. It's bad. I don't know if you could, were you picking that up there
not
too?
Until you said it.
Okay. Yeah. That's a little quieter now. I'm curious what you make, and I hate that we even have to talk about this, but I'm curious as to what you make of it. Like that whole, Because I guess a lot of it does come down to what news you read, what data you take seriously, because I feel like a lot of those games are being played. I feel like I read so much of that right now. They're like, well, yeah, people, you know, people die from the flu all the time. People die from car accidents all the time. You still drive. Like, what do you say to that? I mean, surely that comes up in your Facebook feed too, like as much as it does mine.
So, a few things. One, I just posted a chart, I think it was yesterday. I'm actually going to see if I can pull it up because it was so significant. Kind of tired of hearing this is just, yeah. So, I posted a chart yesterday. I'm going to show it to you because you can see. It looks like this. So, it is a chart that shows on average, in an average April, based on CDC data, how many people die of different things. And the So, you know, like the average amount of people that die from diabetes in an April is what, 6,633 people. Okay. The number two one on here is heart disease. 52,841 deaths from heart disease is typical in an April. This April, we lost 58,760 people to COVID-19. It was the number one cause of death. Of any cause of death in the entire country in April. And why is that statistic so astounding? In April, we were still doing pretty strict social distancing measures across most of the states.
Yeah.
That's with those measures in place.
Yeah.
So the idea of like, yeah, well, people die of the flu, or people comparing it to an average flu season. Look, y'all, you can compare the current deaths to an average flu season, but you're comparing basically a month and a half of deaths to a year.
Right.
It's apples and oranges. Right. And again, you're comparing those deaths while we were already social distancing.
Yeah.
You take that away, it's not going to be a contest. This is not the flu. This is not, oh, so sad, too bad. Mm-hmm. We're talking about if we were to just completely reopen everything tomorrow, no distancing, no masks requirements, just people do whatever they want. We just accept the consequences. Mm-hmm. There would not be a single person in this country who did not know somebody personally who had died. That's what we're looking at. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how seriously contagious this is. And so it's frustrating because my wall gets full of people who go, well, I heard this and I heard that, you know, bad science, things that they just want to twist and manipulate to. And on the one hand, I get it, because denial is a grief coping mechanism.
Yeah.
And the way I keep myself from just blocking and losing my crap on piles of people that I know is reminding myself that denial is a grief coping mechanism. And yeah, we have so many people in this country who are not prepared to really sit with this level of suffering or grief, yeah, right? This is, yeah, so much intersection to the work that I did in my book.
Yes, for sure.
Because we don't have a healthy, robust theology of suffering in white evangelicalism because we want everything to be triumphalism. We don't know what to do when something like this hits.
Right.
So this is the natural outpouring of that is denial. There has to be some other answer. There must be a conspiracy, or there must be a miracle solution, or there must be an easier way than being told, no, you just have to sit in it. You just have to sit at home. Yeah. There isn't something you can do. There isn't some magic fix. Yeah. There isn't some miracle cure. We're asking you to just sit with it for as long as it takes.
Yeah.
We don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
We just don't.
Yeah.
We haven't been spiritually like shepherded into what that looks like. Mm-hmm. We don't know how to sit in grief and lament with the people around us. That's why I think we're just talking about these as statistics as well, you know, 60,000 people died. That's a lot of people. They all have names and families and loved ones. And unlike when it was sort of, you know, when it's terrorism, right? When it's the other, when it's those people killed our people. When we have someone to blame, suddenly we can sit down and we can talk about their names and their stories and their, but this, when it's just a horrible thing that happened, there's not a bad guy, an other, an outsider, an invader to blame. Suddenly nobody knows how to process it anymore. And we sort of have these gloves on arm's length approach of just talking about statistics and talking about things like herd immunity and hoping that we can just accept a certain number of deaths to get the economy going again. And that's a people who don't know how to handle suffering.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. Well, and I feel like you had, even reading up your book, I feel like you're the kind of theology that's there would prepare people for a moment like this. But in absence of that kind of theology, it really isn't surprising that everything inside of us would scream, we've got to against this. Like, there's just no way to just kind of say, it has to be something else. I've not thought about it that way. It has to be a conspiracy theory. There must be some other explanation. There has to, anything.
It's denial. It's denial. They're coping with grief in, you know, the most, I don't want to say infantile, but sort of the easiest way, right, is to just deal with it with denial and to not have to get to any of the other real work of grief, to just stick to the denial of this isn't happening. Mm-hmm. And what's happening right now is deeply traumatic.
Yeah.
It's a lot to take in. Our way of life has been permanently, quite possibly, altered. We will always bear some sort of scars of this, of remembering what this looked like and of knowing that we always have to prepare for this possibility again, right? So in a way, everything we've known has changed forever. Even if we can defeat this virus, our way of life is permanently altered. Our sense of security will be permanently changed if we face this the way we should. But since we have a whole, you know, two generations, if not three generations of people who have been sort of spiritually shepherded to not deal with things.
Right.
Nobody knows what to do with that. That's more than we've been taught to handle. There is no false triumphalism in that. So instead you get, and I'll name names, you get John Piper's new book claiming, you know, let's show where God is in COVID. Like, you go one extreme over there, or you have the other extreme of this isn't really happening. Because those are the only two ways left to you to deal with it when you don't know how to just sit in it and deal with it head on.
This podcast is brought to you by the generosity of our patrons. Please consider supporting the show. The Zeitcast with Jonathan Martin will be right back.
I wanted to ask you specifically about, because when you were riffing on this a little bit before we started recording, I thought this was so interesting and provocative, just your sense of, and I'm not trying to get you to repeat this exactly, but you were talking about, and I may kind of have two questions in one here.
Okay.
I feel like I hear a lot of people reflecting already, specifically for churches. I think there is a sense that inevitably things are changing in ways that probably will have some kind of lasting implications, though nobody knows exactly what that's going to look like. But you were talking a little bit about what you anticipate there, and even the kind of think pieces you could imagine happening. I've been very intrigued because, you know, like in our case, you know, I know, like, even kind of with our table community, and, like, don't get me wrong, I mean, I think there are things about kind of like the physicality of certain Christian practices that I think are really beautiful.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. It's like, I feel like, and I think anybody in our community would say this, I think we've been kind of shocked at how intimate and close that we have been. Like, it seems like we're the closest we've ever been while physically isolated. And but, you know, there are all these, even like among our mainline friends, I've seen like the debates are raging right now about the merits of virtual communion.
Right.
You know, I'm just curious, like, of what your sense is of what's coming specifically for the church on how we reflect on this particular moment and what it means for how we move forward.
So as is typical of me, I have kind of a conflicting both and on things. And I just think that's just reflective of our big both and God, right? Like there's just a lot less either ors than we like to think in the faith and a lot more both ands. And a lot of things that are seemingly in conflict are just sort of this holy discord, if you will, of it's both true. And this is one of those things where on the one hand, you know, I do think that there is a danger of sliding into full bore Gnosticism where our bodies don't matter and we're all just, you know, just a soul and this is a shell. And like, that's when I agree with the camp that says, let's not go there. And yet on the flip side, as a person who lives in a disabled and chronically ill body, a lot of the work that I do in ministry, a lot of the relationships that I have that are really meaningful, deep relationships. Like, let's be honest, I think the only time that you and I have physically, no, that's not true. There's been two times in our entire life that we have been physically in the same place, right? Once was at the Prophets and Poets event in Portland and then at Evolving Faith this last year.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
And yet I would consider you one of my closest friends right now.
Yeah, same here, for sure.
So, like, the idea that you have to be physically present with each other, it gets real complicated when you're a disabled person. There's a certain amount of ableism that's inherently present in that idea that, well, you know, we hear a lot of the activism on the internet doesn't count. You have to get out there and march in the streets and really do something. The doing is what makes it count. The idea that these online relationships are not real. They are sort of pseudo shells of a relationship, but you have to physically do life with these people for it to count. And we're seeing the same thing sort of carry over into church, right? That real church is sitting shoulder to shoulder with each other in the same pews. And church ministry, right, is those who's up there, you know, passing the communion and who's staying after church to set up the chairs. And like, that's real ministry. The rest of it doesn't count. But when you live in a disabled body, sometimes those things will never be an option for you. This is the only way that some people who are housebound can do church. I have seen an enormous number of people in the disability community say that this has been a good time for them because there are more options for them to be connected to church than there were before.
Wow.
Right? Like for them, this hasn't been a time of more disconnection. This has been more opportunities to connect than they have ever been presented with in their life. A virtual smorgasbord of church community that's willing to meet them where they're at home in their bed or in their living room. And so for many of us, our biggest fear, myself included, is that some of those strides are going to get taken right back again.
Right.
Because people are already singing the song of, I can't wait till we don't have to do this anymore. And so for people who this is their lived experience, a majority of the time, this is not a temporary thing. They are often housebound. They're watching this going, see, I knew you could meet me where I'm at. I knew you could have Zoom meeting Bible studies so that I could be included, or that you could record services if you were a church that wasn't doing that before, or you could live stream it instead of recording it so that we all felt like we're together. All kinds of requests that we've made for years are suddenly possible. We know now that they're possible. So it's going to hurt that much more if churches just sort of shrug their shoulders and take it all back and say, well, now that we can do real church, we don't need that fake stuff anymore.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. And having no idea what that feels like to say, that to call that fake in some way. It's interesting too, because in a weird way, I just think considering where the world is going, I mean, to me, it seems like it's the Spirit of God, at least conceivably, posturing us for the future, and yet to say those things just feels like, I don't know. It's interesting how loving the people who are most vulnerable among us, I think simultaneously, is also, I don't know. I have this weird riff. I think about it always when I think about like the early Pentecostal movement too, that like, whatever is best for the most vulnerable among us is also the really futuristic thing the Spirit of God is doing, you know? Well, so like there's
that
always
jives with this idea that like, I feel so strongly right now that, hey, churches, like if you're struggling with what it looks like right now to have to do church online, like that would have been a prime opportunity to seek out disabled people who have been doing community online for decades. Wow. Yeah. We've had two decades of experience of what it looks like to take, you know, the wild west of the internet and turn it into something that fostered real meaningful community for us and real opportunities to do ministry, to do activism, to seek justice, to love our neighbor. We've had a lot of trial and error practice at that I'll be honest, some of y'all that are able are new to that. Mm-hmm. And it's not saying, you know, we have all the answers. It's saying there is a host, just a wealth of knowledge and wisdom and lived insight there that's kind of going untapped. Because I see Zoom meetings, right? People are talking about pastors getting online together and all chatting with each other about the challenges of doing this internet church thing. Mm-hmm. And I just want to scream at the top of my lungs, like, why would you not bring someone into that equation who's done this, who can say, right, I've gone before, I know what it looks like.
Right.
And I think in the beginning, a lot of it was people clinging to the hope that this is a temporary little blip, that we're just going to stay home for 2 weeks and the virus is going to somehow magically disappear in those two weeks of us staying home. And then we're all going to come out and go back to life.
Yeah.
But as we're starting to process that this is going to be with us for a while, we're going to need to make some long-term changes for at least the next year or two. I would desperately hope that people would tap into that wealth of resources and seek out people who have been doing online community for most of their life because they don't have any other choices. This is where they do community.
Mm-hmm. Our friend, knowing that you guys are such good friends, talking with Mike McCargo a few weeks ago, he specifically said to me that I don't know that I've ever felt less lonely than I do right now. And I interesting thing to say that to be experiencing social distancing and to have never felt less lonely, that is possible right now. And a lot of things are possible that weren't possible before. You know, our table gatherings, we've had people coming in and doing worship and being involved with teaching and stuff from all over the world. We wouldn't have been able to do that. I mean, like, we've been around for a year. We couldn't have afforded to bring these people in and have hotels and honorariums and all this stuff.
Well, and that's like, another one that I hope sticks, but I'm a little nervous about, right? Mm-hmm. Is people are suddenly very open to speakers coming in digitally.
Yeah.
Whereas I know there are folks like Tanya Marlowe, folks like Shannon Dingle, folks like me who have been asking for that exact thing from major conferences for a long time who have said, well, it would just ruin the experience. It's not the same thing. We really need you in person. And suddenly, now that, you know, a majority of able people need it too, now it's okay to do it. Like, we see this. We're not going to forget. We're going to remember that it was possible when the rest of y'all needed it too. So it's possible when it's only the vulnerable that are asking for it. It's just a choice to put that back in the bag and pretend it never happened. And I don't know. I don't think I will ever be comfortable going, oh, okay, I'll just accept that that's not a thing that anyone does. I've seen you do it now.
Right.
I know it's possible.
Right. Wow. That's so good, Stephanie. I love that. So to kind of bring it back kind of full circle to you, knowing that there kind of is no end in sight for you and your family. Like, there is going to be no, like, everybody goes to Applebee's on Sunday and like all of these things, which again, my head is still spinning. All of this is, I don't know. I think that
it's
there was
traumatic.
A part of
it. Give yourself some space. It's traumatic. Your brain is having a hard time processing it because it is. It's trauma. We're not wired to just accept things like this. It takes multi-step processing.
Oh, for sure. I think the moment, like, the decision was to kick things over to states, you kind of did turn things over to the mercy of, well, depending on the news sources people are listening to, they're going to be clamoring. I mean, this was where it's going to go, is that there was going to be kind of a there was going to be a race in certain states in particular to see who could open the fastest. And that's exactly kind of how all this is kind of playing out. I'm just what is sort of your sense of, like, what does life look like for you guys for the next few weeks, the next few months? What are your hopes, your dreams, your prayer? Like, is it hitting a place now where you guys feel more settled in because this has gone on so long? Is there, or does it feel more and more, does it feel harder the longer that it goes? Or is there more of a rhythm that kind of settles the longer?
That's a great question. This is my chance to say, like, I think I get a lot of flack right now for being that person who's out there, like, it's too soon to reopen. It's too soon to reopen. What are we doing? And it gets portrayed very easily as, like, we should all just sit in our houses forever until there's a vaccine, which is not what I'm saying. Mm. Like, for me, ideally, I want to be clear and speak past tense first, that the whole point of us staying home these past number of weeks was to buy time to take the appropriate steps. And I want to be clear that there are other countries who have actually done this successfully. So this is not a pie in the sky dream. The point of the sacrifice of us staying home for the last month plus was they were supposed to be ramping up the amount of tests they were producing. They were supposed to be getting in place a really stringent and far-reaching contract chasing method, so that if you went to a grocery store and they found out the next week that someone in that store had COVID, they would know via cell phone data or whatever else they use, hey, you might have been exposed, so that we could get all those cases locked down, right? And they were supposed to be getting enough PPE, that means personal protective equipment, for not just healthcare workers, but for everybody who's going to have to go to work and wear a mask and need these things. And also enough disinfectant. Because, I think my earphones just went out for a minute. Enough disinfectant, because have you tried to buy Lysol or Clorox wipes in the last few weeks? Yeah. So this idea that everyone's promoting of, like, well, you can just go back to work and practice proper hygiene, like, well, that would be great. But if you can't buy disinfectant or hand sanitizer, that's not possible. So they were supposed to be doing that with these last few weeks. Mm-hmm. And instead, it just turned into a, like, pass the cow pie, if you will, party of, like, who's left holding the crap in their hands at the end so we can blame that person. Yeah. They have not done any of those steps. Mm-hmm. So people like me that are saying, hey, we can't reopen yet, we are not saying we're just sitting terrified in our houses and we never want anyone to come out. Right. What we're saying is we were supposed to be doing something with this time. We haven't done any of those things yet. So if we could get off our butts and do those things, mm-hmm. and this is one of those times where, man, I know I rail on capitalism a lot because I'm a disabled person and it's just an inherently ableist system. Sure. But this is where we have been so trained to eat whatever we're being fed and regurgitate it back out and act like this was our idea in the first place, right? Because instead of complaining about that, instead of targeting our anger at that right place and saying, guys, we need to produce more disinfectant, we need to get more tests, we're out there screaming at each other about people who have lost their jobs and have no income, about people who, you know, reopen this, reopen that, we can't live like this. You're right, we can't live like this. Yeah. But the problem is not that we're still closed. The problem is not that, you know, people are at home without income. The problem is that we didn't do the steps to get back out and have that income again.
Right.
So for me, in the next few weeks, all I'm focusing my efforts on is calling senators, sending those emails, and reminding them, like, hey, there was a plan. That plan was written out. It's in place. It says we shouldn't open states until these goalposts have been met. Yeah. They haven't been met. So
in a single state.
No, right? not in one of 50 states, not one. So where is the PPE? Where is the readily available disinfectant? Where are the steps that we need to do this safely? So instead of turning on each other and yelling at your friend that wants to stay home saying, well, hey, my family is starving and, you know, can't get unemployment and how dare you? And instead of yelling at your friend that wants to reopen because they're desperate and they don't have a paycheck, we both need to be focusing our complaints on the correct place, which is, why is our government not providing us with the proper steps to reopen safely?
Yes, yes.
We should be on the same team on this. They have the ability to provide the appropriate aid to keep people home until it's safe. I know those are big economic concepts, but hey, the the global economy doesn't actually work like your home checkbook. So this idea of like only writing for the money you have, like I understand that. That's not actually how big macroeconomics work. It would take way too long to explain in a show like this. But let me just say, they do have the ability to write us aid, like real aid, like the other countries have, where we have monthly income to stay home until it's safe and focus Absolutely. Their efforts on producing that stuff.
Absolutely.
That is where our efforts should be right now in imagining what a better future looks like, not fighting over how long we should or shouldn't stay home. Like we all need to get on the same team and fight for an opening. Absolutely. I want to reopen too, but I want to do it in a way that's safe for everybody, where I'm not terrified because my 66-year-old father just went back to work yesterday and does not have appropriate PPE and does not have the things he needs to be safe. He's got a crappy fabric mask that I sent him off eBay and some filters Wow. and some hand sanitizer that I managed to scrounge up and ship to him. That's it. And he is a crew foreman for a construction company who has to meet with people all day long now and put himself in jeopardy because the state of California decided that, or at least the Bay Area did where he is, that construction can start now. So all these people saying, oh, it'll be okay because the vulnerable can still shelter at home. Newsflash, it doesn't actually work that way. Once a business reopens, if you don't go back to work, you sacrifice your unemployment.
Right.
So if you really want a world in which you're saying the vulnerable can stay safe and everyone else can choose to go out, before you reopen, you should be pushing your state to have something in place that actually provides for the people that do need to stay home. These are all reasonable goals, but we have to stop fighting each other if we're going to get there.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely, I love everything you're saying, Stephen. I love the clarity of it. And I feel like it's so clear. It's so true. And none of this, I wish I knew a better way to communicate this to people. None of this is partisan at all. Like, this is what government is for. These are basic expectations Yes. of government. It has nothing to do with party affiliation. I mean, like, this is, one of my personal friends was on the National Security Council, part of the transition team, actually grew up Republican, from Obama to Trump, that had the plan in place. Of course, you couldn't have anticipated COVID-19 in particular, but they had a plan for a virus that would have checked Yes. off 16 of the 19 things, something Yep. like this. We absolutely did anticipate. We absolutely did have plans for, theoretically, we totally should be able to do all of these things. This is really what government is for. And the idea that there are no mechanisms in place, that there's no structure, that we act completely befuddled and blindsided and like, we don't know what to do. Like, it's just ridiculous. And yes, then that game of just back and forth of like people acting like it's their neighbor's fault somehow. that's just, it's just maddening, because this really is such a moment where we should be united and calling on our leaders to do the things that we've elected them to do. That's so clear and so helpful.
This is one of those times that it's really interesting to be married to a Canadian, right? Mm. Because my husband's parents are about the most conservative people you will ever meet, yeah. right? My husband's mother, the only movie she has ever seen in a movie theater is The Passion of a Christ.
Wow.
Because she comes from that Pentecostal background where you don't go to movie theaters because if the rapture comes, you might not get taken because movie theaters are just, you know, sin palaces. We don't go there.
Sure.
Like he, you know, they are the most conservatives I know, but they're also Canadian. Mm. So what that looks like politically in Canada is completely different from what that looks like politically in the United States. They're watching our response to this and they think we're nuts.
Sure.
Because it's not a partisan issue to them. They're not up there having mass protests demanding that they be allowed to go back to work.
Right.
They're listening to their government and saying, okay, what's safe for us to do next? How do we rally around our neighbors? Their government made sure that everybody got checks that support them. Mm-hmm. I will brag on my husband's parents and say they are the most Canadian little people ever because Canadian culture is so very much about what's the collective good over what's like your individual freedom.
Yeah.
That's just how they are. As sort of a national culture. And so his very conservative parents, we asked them how they were doing with all this and if they got their $2,000 a month from the government. And they go, well, you know, you just fill out a form and apply and you get it. But we didn't really need it because we live on our retirement. We have set bills. So we just didn't apply.
Wow.
And on our brain, we're like, you did what? Like, oh, I can't God. Even, you just turned down free money. And they were like, well, yeah, because if you don't really need it, you know, we're going to leave it and make sure that the government has enough money to go around forever. That's good, how they are up there. Like, that's it's amazing. So wildly different from here. Mm-hmm. So hearing their like reflections of how scared they are for us. Yeah. And there, down here, they would be as far right as you can possibly be culturally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet they're looking at this going, there is nothing political about a pandemic.
Right.
They can't understand how we're dealing with this. And they're legitimately scared for us.
Yeah.
Because they can't process our reaction to this and why we can't all collectively come together in this mm-hmm. instead of fighting each other.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. That's heartening and discouraging at the same time too, right? You know, because I do feel like it's like,
I don't know if it's laugh or cry, but
this is like, it is, it does. It feels like, I'm like, I do so often. I'm like, it is like we're living in the Wild West out here. It's like, yeah. what are we doing right now? It's so, it's just like,
but I think we need to be aware that that's exactly why they are doubling down so hard on the propaganda and the trying to divide us with the media, right? Because yeah. this has exposed so many of the obvious flaws in our system.
Yeah.
And that's a scary yeah. time for that's systems right. like this, because this that's is exactly right. when people look at them and go, well, if they're not working, then maybe we don't do it that way anymore.
Yeah.
So the more we're fighting each other, the yeah. less they have to worry about us collectively getting together and saying, this is a system that doesn't work for marginalized people, yeah. not because we have a pandemic, but because it's mm-hmm. never worked for marginalized people.
Right.
So
right.
if we're going to have to redo things temporarily to make it work, maybe we don't redo them temporarily. Maybe yeah. we make some of these changes for good. But yeah. as long as we're squabbling with each other and we're convinced that, you know, that guy on the other side is the problem because he's not letting us reopen, or that woman over there is the problem because we're reopening too early. That keeps us from collectively coming together and identifying what the real problems are here and fighting for a better world that's better for everybody and not just for the majority.
Yeah. That's so good, Stephanie. I feel like that's a perfect place to land. I'm just, as always, I'm so grateful for your voice. I'm so grateful for your friendship. And I just love when we talk like this. As always, I feel like, you know, we get into just a flow and a groove, and that Holy Ghost magic just kind of comes out. So this is just, but I do, I want to give a plug for your book one more time, as always do, because I think it's so important. So I'll make sure also when we're putting this out on social media to put links up for the book as well, because I love it so much. I so love you and appreciate you, love your family. So praying for you guys, and just grateful that in the midst of all this chaos and in all the challenges, that you are taking the time and using so much energy to speak out in the way that you're doing, because it matters so much. Really does. Makes such a difference.
I'm trying. I won't lie. I'm getting real tired, and I'm going to have to start taking more breaks on this, because it's wearing. It's wearing. I didn't really answer your earlier question, but no, it's not getting easier as time goes on. I'm getting weary. I need some kind of better break. But on the flip side, you know, this is what it's like to be a person who's speaking out of their own marginalized experience. You don't have the luxury or the freedom to say, well, I'm just going to stop and let everybody sort it out, because we've seen what happens. They don't fix it. You get thrown under the bus. So you have that sort of air hanging over you of, you have to keep speaking because your life depends on it. So you want to help somebody like me, your job is to get out there and say these things for me, so I don't feel like I have no choice but to keep pouring out of an empty cup, right?
Yeah. That's so important, Stephanie. Thank you. And thank you for this time, friend. It's just been so good, as always.
Thank you for joining us today on The Zeitcast with Jonathan Martin. The Zeitcast is brought to you by the generosity of our patrons. If you are enjoying this podcast, consider rating it, writing a review, or sharing with a friend. We couldn't do this without you. To learn more about Jonathan and to support this podcast, visit jonathanmartin.com.